Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
I want to encourage you to call in to talk today. We're talking with Professor Angela O'Donnell about Flannery O'Connor. And you can call in at 1-888-322-8465. To join the conversation, you can also tweet at us at America Mag or at America Editor. And if you're interested in following those of us who are here, I'm at MT Reedy, and Professor O'Donnell is at AO Donnell Angela. Now, I thought, Professor O'Donnell, I'd quote here. I wanted to mention that Flannery O'Connor did write for America once back in 1957 on an essay that's still kind of talked about the church and the fiction writer. Just a little background, this is an essay that appeared. Was edited slightly by the editors of America. One paragraph was dropped, and Miss O'Connor took exception to this, a young 32-year-old author.
Like almost every writer.
And she never wrote for us again, so I'm not sure if that was the reason. But I wanted to read one line here, which I think is kind of echoes some of the things we're talking about. And she says, "What the fiction writer will discover, if he discovers anything at all, is that he himself cannot move or mold reality in the interests of abstract truth. The writer learns perhaps more quickly than the reader to be humble in the face of what is." So that's what she's trying to do, is just describe the world as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. O'Connor believed that she had what is sometimes called by the theologian David Tracy the analogical imagination, mm-hmm. that the world bodies forth God in all ways, in every way. And the role of the fiction writer is really to help the reader to see and understand the mystery that underlies the world of appearances that is there all the time. But God doesn't work through abstraction. God works through concrete reality, and we only come to understand mystery through our senses, except in the case of contemplatives who are able to somehow to leap over that kind of contemplation at the highest level. So the world of the senses is the world that the fiction writer lives in and tries to shape in a way so that the reader will recognize something that is familiar, but also have a kind of an epiphany to see the strangeness of it, the supernatural aspects of the natural world, basically, is what she's trying to do. When she began a story, she really didn't know where it was going because she had to trust that process to take her, and all writers know this, Catholic and not. You have to trust the process. Robert Frost uses the image of the piece of ice on the hot stove. You need to just follow it out.
You think you're doing something, but then you wind up doing something very different.
Absolutely, yeah. And she says in one of her stories, for example, Good Country People, there's a scene in which she creates a young woman who has a lot of as we say these days, a lot of issues. She's a very unhappy person. And one of the things that's wrong with her is, or terrible things that has happened to her, is she had her leg blown off in a hunting accident, and she has a wooden leg. And she encounters this awful man who, in the course of the story, actually steals her leg, which is her prized possession. And Flannery says about that story, "I had no idea that he was going to steal the leg until he did it."
right. That's right. So you're listening to America This Week. You can join the conversation at 1-888-322-8465, 888-322-8465, to join the conversation about Catholic literature and Flannery O'Connor. What is the work that feeds you as a Catholic that kind of fires your imagination? Angela, you know, one of the things that really strikes me about O'Connor is this sense that of the radical nature of truth and grace. And so, in other words, you know, when she would say something like the world is charged with the grandeur of God, that creation is essentially good. These were not platitudes, right? These were actually rather scandalous notions in the true sense of the word, right? Mm-hmm. That they undermine our own kind of cherished ideologies or ideas about how the world is and how it ought to be. Like there's a kind of radical deconstruction going on in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally countercultural, these ideas to the world that she is writing for. And it's interesting, that lovely line from Hopkins, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." O'Connor is such a nuts and bolts writer, such an incarnational writer. Mm-hmm. She would never say something like that.
Right.
She would show it, you know.
Right, exactly, right.
And so it's all about, again, trying to use the natural world, the occurrence, everyday occurrences, everyday ordinary people to body forth these truths
right.
that are there.
But there's a sense in which, you know, if you, I think you see in O'Connor a real, a great Catholic imagination at work because, you know, when you read her work, you realize that an encounter with the gospel is actually hugely destabilizing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That and that it's intended to be, right? If you come away from an encounter with the gospel with your worldview affirmed, then you have seriously missed the point, right?
No, that's very true.
Right.
In fact, in one of her stories, Revelation, this starts with a woman who is very pious. She thinks she's saved, you know, in the Southern Baptist, you know, language of thinking that she's going to heaven. And She is a good woman in many ways, but she finds out in the course of the story that she's terribly flawed because she really does have a serious encounter with gospel truth. And it destroys her. It destroys
mm-hmm.
her.
Mm-hmm.
But again, hopefully there is room for her to be able to accept that grace and come to a recognition that she has to change. She has
right,
to change
right.
entirely. It's the dying to self. It's losing her life in order to find it. One can't help but think of all of these passages from Scripture when you read O'Connor, because sometimes they're subtle and in the background, sometimes she just brings them out
right.
directly. Go ahead.
No, one of the reasons we know about this and, you know, kind of her reflections on these matters is because in addition to all of her fiction, we also have her letters. We also have some of her essays, Mystery and Manners, which you have there. So maybe you can talk a bit about that she was, in a way, also telling her own story and her own faith journey.
Yeah, there was wonderful biographies of Flannery O'Connor out there. Paul Eli's book is fantastic, The Life You Saved May Be Your Own. Brad Gooch's biography is very good. Jill Baumgartner's biography is very good, A Proper Scaring. But the best way to get to know O'Connor is just to sit down and read her letters.
Right.
Hundreds of wonderful letters that were culled out and collected by her dear friend Sally Fitzgerald. In which she talks about her faith in very powerful ways. What you learn, for example, O'Connor was an omnivorous reader. She was constantly trying to improve her mind, as she would say, and she was reading contemporary theologians. She loved Teilhard de Chardin, who at the time, by the way, was not somebody that the church did not accept his writings.
Right.
She would ask permission from her Jesuit friend
right, exactly.
if she could read these things. And then they would enter into her stories. Her story, Everything That Rises Must Converge,
right.
comes right out of Teilhard.
Right.
So you see that this is a living faith that is being fed by spiritual writers. She loved Romano Guardini. And then she would put them into practice mm-hmm. in the stories that she's writing.
Well, you can join the conversation at 888-322-8465. That's 888-322-8465. This is America This Week, and we're talking about Flannery O'Connor, and we are joined by Anne-Marie in Houston. Anne-Marie, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you, Anne-Marie?
Good. How are you?
Welcome to America This Week.
Thank you. I was just calling to find out. I've heard of Flannery O'Connor, and I'm an avid reader. But I don't know where to start. I've never read any of her work. What would be a good entry work to start with?
Oh, you are asking exactly the right person, Anne-Marie.
As a matter of fact, I just prepared my syllabus for talking about Flannery O'Connor tomorrow. So, it really is a great. One of the things that's great about O'Connor is her best work are short stories, and so it's a pretty easy entry. And the stories that I would suggest, if you're looking for stories that have some Catholic content, there's a wonderful story called. The name, of course, just eludes me because A Temple of the Holy Ghost, about a little girl who is Catholic and is trying to figure out how to live in the South as a Catholic. You can tell that it's autobiographical when you read it beside her letters, but her kind of most famous story by far is A Good Man Is Hard to Find,
mm-hmm.
and it's a blockbuster of a story. It will just set the reader on his head, as it should, because this is what happens to the characters in the course of the story. I also highly recommend Revelation, which was one of O'Connor's favorite stories that she wrote, and she wrote it right at the end of her life. Her favorite story was a story called Parker's Back, which I also like a great deal. And it took her a long time to finish it. She actually was working on that on her deathbed. She finished it days before, and she was so grateful to be able to finish it.
Yeah,
she would hide her notebooks under her pillow because she was afraid that the nurses would take away her writing, and then she would write when people were not in the room.
Anne Marie, are you a Southerner by birth? Did you grow up in the South?
Born and raised in Houston, Texas.
Oh, okay. So you might have a take on Flannery O'Connor that we Yankees would not.
Oh, that's very true. Because one of the things that Flannery said is that the most important thing for a fiction writer is to get the idiom of the place that you're writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And Flannery's ear is impeccable. That you'll find, I think, Anne-Marie, the dialogue is fantastic. It's exactly what you would hear people, the exchanges you would hear in the Piggly Wiggly, you know. But at the same time, there is this other element of strangeness that enters into the ordinary. But you know, I lived in the South for 7 years, so I can say this. The South is a really strange place.
Okay. So, well, Anne Marie, thank you very much for your call, and enjoy your journey into the world of Flannery O'Connor.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'd like to mention here that you have just published, Angela, a memoir of your own, Mortal Blessings, A Sacramental Farewell, where you write about caring for your mother in her last days. I wonder if there's anything, like, you've prayed with Flannery O'Connor before, you've written about her before. Was there anything about that process that kind of helped inform this book?
Yes, actually. You know, when you have been reading a writer for a very long time, they become your friends.
Right.
You know, you think of them as being your soulmates and people that you have conversation with, in a sense. In fact, I remember vividly that when I was in the hospital having my second son, I had just been reading Flannery O'Connor's The Displaced Person, and I felt like Mrs. Shortley was in the room with me. So, I mean, there are very intimate moments of my life when Flannery was there. This book is about my mother, the last 48 days of my mother's life, and the way that my sisters and I cared for her. And it's a book about ordinary sacraments, the ordinary sacraments of care. And Flannery would be there in the room with me as I was taking care of her. I thought of her, for example, when I would wheel my mother in her wheelchair from room to room. I was remembering how in that story, Revelation, that I mentioned earlier, one of the lessons that Mrs. Turpin has to learn is that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. She thinks she's one of the first of God's beloved, and she finds out that that's not necessarily the case. And one of the things that you do when you take care of an elderly parent is you put their needs entirely before your own.
Right.
And, of course, when you were a child, your parent put your needs entirely before her own, and the tables are turned. And so that kind of that scriptural verity became true for me as it comes through your senses as I was pushing it, the wheelchair through the halls, and my mother was in front. She was first, and I was behind her, and I was last. So she was always there in these kinds of ways, because I think of her as one of my spiritual teachers, as well as a writer that I admire.
Sure, and she also had a very special relationship with her mother, didn't she?
She did. Let's put special in quotation.
Right.
And I had a very special relationship with mine as well.
Right. She,
at one point in one of her letters, she says that when she's living up in New York and she's writing her novel and it's been accepted by a publisher and it looks like her life is taking off. She's 25. She has the world all before her. And she says, if it weren't for my mother, I would never go back to Georgia.
Yeah.
So she wrote her mother a letter or a postcard every single day when she was at Iowa, and then when she was living in New York, and then when she was living in Connecticut with Robert Fitzgerald and his family. Now, so there was a closeness there. She was an only child. But also, Regina did not understand Flannery. She did not get her. She thought her stories were kind of, well, they were. She thought they were outrageous. She would say, why don't you write about happy things?
Right.
And then, of course, she had to live in the same house with her mother as a grown woman, and that was difficult for her because, you know, her mother had a particular kind of personality, and Flannery had to she put up with her. It was a slightly purgatorial experience for her, if one can be slightly in a slight purgatory. So it was difficult for her. But the two women managed to live together. They went to mass together every day. They went to lunch together every day.
Wow.
They were. And I often think of, I would love to overhear their conversations.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Well, we have another caller on the line from New Mexico, so we want to welcome them into the conversation.
Robert, welcome to the conversation.
Hi. It's a pleasure to reach you. I'm on the road, and I am hoping I'll have a cell phone signal throughout this call, but
okay.
You might lose me. Your conversation is touching on many points of interest for me. Most recently is you just reminded me of Flannery O'Connor's comment that if her mother had a dog, she'd name the dog Spot. And if Flannery O'Connor had a dog, she'd name the dog Spot too. But with irony.
Thank you for reminding us of that, yes. Robert. That is fabulous.
Indeed. Have you read a lot of Flannery O'Connor, Robert?
I have from time to time, and I really have two comments. This program is causing me to want to go back and reread her because it's been years.
Mm-hmm.
The first comment is just to name my favorite piece by Flannery O'Connor. And it's the introduction to the memoir of Mary Ann. I think in your conversation, you indicated that you had the book, I think it's called Mystery and Manners, there in the studio with you. And for sort of revealing the arc of her thought and her thinking about stories, I can't think of anything better.
Sure.
And it is... It does rise to the level of, I think one story is titled Everything That Rises Must Converge, and one thing that happens at the end of that story is you wonder, well, why in the world did she name it that?
Right.
But in this essay, you sort of get a transcendent dimension that you don't always get on first reading in her story.
Sure,
yeah,
sure. And Robert, quickly, what is the second thing you wanted to add?
The second thing I wanted to add is that I find her characters very hard-nosed and isolated. I don't find characters in communion or led into communion with one another. I don't find absolutely visible breakthroughs of grace. Instead, I find this kind of hard-edged, somewhat scary, isolated reality. And so she reminds me a little bit of Kierkegaard in that
sure.
way.
Sure, sure. Robert, hold on 1 second. Let's get Angela's response to that, because I think that's a common reaction to reading O'Connor.
Absolutely. And one of the besetting sins of human beings that O'Connor likes to deal with again and again is this idea of the false self.
Right.
The false self that we fabricate and that we live by, that does set itself on a kind of pedestal, that does set itself apart from other human beings. And we need to be brought into common humanity with one another by recognizing the falseness of that self. And again, as we've mentioned earlier, this usually comes through some violent action. And I think oftentimes what happens is O'Connor leaves her character in a liminal space, on the cusp of that recognition. So we don't necessarily see the character enter back into community with people, but the door is open for that to happen.
Right.
That open-endedness is characteristic of O'Connor's endings, which is one of the things that makes them powerful. She doesn't tell you everything that happens. She leaves it up to the reader's imagination to try to figure out, so what is the next step of the character who has her dreams shattered, her illusions shattered, who has her wooden leg stolen away by someone who she thought was a nice man, a Bible salesman, when she's left alone. She has been talking about her mother as though she was a foolish, garrulous old woman.
Right.
She feels she has the PhD in philosophy, so she's smarter than everybody around her. And suddenly she realizes she's actually pretty dumb. but we don't see her go back to the house and apologize to her mother. She's left up in the barn loft, literally without a leg to stand on, and no glasses, and we just don't know what Holga does next.
Right, right.
So I do think that she opens the door to that reconnection with other human beings, but we don't always see it happen.
Well, Robert, from New Mexico, thank you for your call, and because it was a really terrific question, and I think really the, probably a very common reaction, as I said, among people who are who read Flannery O'Connor for the first time. It was probably my reaction, and then when I went back later in life and reread it, of course, I had a different reaction. But that's part of it, isn't it? You relate to an author and to a work differently at a different at different stages in your own life.
Yeah, actually, that's a really nice point. The first time I read O'Connor, I was 18. I'm a little older than that now. And one of the stories that was mentioned, the Everything That Rises Must Converge, features a son who is, he thinks he's smarter than his mother. And they have differences over race. Remember, this is a story that's written right on the cusp of the civil rights movement. And the mother is an old Southern lady with all sorts of benighted ideas about race, and the son is much more progressive. So he treats her very badly throughout the story. And when I was a kid, when I was reading that story, I thought, oh, she is insufferable. How does he put up with her? She's just awful. However, now reading this as an adult, I realize that the son is also pretty insufferable. I will add that I have three sons. They're not like Julian, but I do know what it's like to be the parent who has a child who, you know, thinks that they know more than you do, regardless of what the issue is. So I think a good story makes that happen to you. You know, just like with Hamlet, you can see from all the characters' perspectives at any given moment. This is true of O'Connor's stories as well.
Well, we want to thank Professor Angela O'Donnell for this great conversation. We could keep going, and we will, up at St. Joseph's Seminary.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.